first hour, if you missed it, the Muslim mafia inside the secret underworld that's conspiring to Islamize America. That's their verb on that. And that's co-authors with Paul Sperry. We had the co-author of that book on in the first hour. If you go back and you listen to that in the podcast, I think you really enjoy it. Stream link also for tomorrow night. If you can't catch it live, you want to be listening for this show. It's about DARPA. It's about the latest mad scientry that's going on right now all across the United States. And some of the projects that are coming to fruition, some of these truly like fringe things that the government has been funding, in many cases, they don't even have an application for it yet. They just want to see if they can do stuff. So a lot of robotics, a lot of electronics, a lot of nanotechnology, some interesting work with animals and insects, and we'll hear all about it coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. And if you go online, you got a blog up with some fun links, including it's a pretty weird thing. Like cows milking themselves and other stuff that just popped up during the week, and so I put it all together on the blog, including some thoughts about what happened in Fort Hood as well. So tie it all together, go to coasttocoastam.com, sign up for Streamlink, and then you can stay with us through all of the turnings ahead, past, present, and future. You've always got Streamlink at your disposal. coasttocoastam.com is where you can sign up for that. Going into the last hour, phones are filling up for Neil Howe on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Neil Howe, I know there's so many different directions we've already been in, and I'm sure that we'll go in many different interesting ones here when we get to the questions. I did have one quick follow-up, though, and I never got back to an answer. So at some point this hour, I want to ask you about if you had to choose a business direction, if you wanted to, if we're going to be totally Machiavellian about the fourth turning, what might be that business position that one could be in? And since you brought up talk radio, about, you know, how baby boomers argued with each other, and that was typical sort of baby boomer behavior. I want to ask about talk radio of the future, too. But first, let's get to Joe, west of the Rockies in Tucson, for Neil Howe on Coast to Coast. Joe?
Hello, Ian and Mr. Howe. I'm big fans of you both. And my question would be real quick. I've read The Fourth Turning, and I think it's a great book. And I just have a quick question about how the generational cycles affect other countries. Are they on the same, the same cycle as the United States? And
great question. Great question.
Yeah. And Ian, if I could say one more thing, my sister in New York, Emily, she's your biggest fan. She told me to say that. So
Emily, you rock. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Thank you, Emily. And so Neil, where do you go with that?
Joe, that's a great question. And, you know, in recent years, I've actually been increasingly to Europe and to China and talking to people there about generations. It is global. It's certainly not unique to the United States. In fact, the whole generational dynamic arises in any non-traditional society where, you know, young adults can form new generations and can recast or reshape institutions as they grow older. So we certainly see this today in much of the 20th century and most of the world. Since the World War II and the Great Depression, certainly all of the developed world, including all of the English-speaking world, all of Europe, including Russia, and Eastern Asia, have all shown many of the same generational rhythms. A little bit later in other countries, so their generations are, you know, often a little bit younger, but the same basic rhythms. We've, you know, what we call the GI generation, who emerged from World War II, we see throughout this part of the world. I mean, obviously in Europe, there was the Axis soldier generation, the resistance generation. In China, there was the Red Guard generation that founded the People's Republic of China in 1948. In India, there was the, you know, the partition generation that presided over the birth of that nation. So in all of these areas, this was a great civic generation.
But let me throw out to Joe's question. How can you have a generation of isolationists in the 30s in the United States at the time when there's a generation of aggressive military expansionists in Germany?
Well, just as we were discussing, these are two different sides of the same generation. They became the generation that came. First of all, the generation that came of age in that era did not create the policy, right? They were simply thrust into the situation, and it required mobilizing on a vast scale, being loyal to these enormous institutions. Enormous battles and struggles were being fought, and they tied themselves collectively to the resolution of some great historical challenge, right? I mean, that was true about all these societies.
Fair enough.
Whatever side you were on.
No, I think that's fair enough. I appreciate that. Dan's in Boulder, Colorado on Coast to Coast. First-time caller line for Neil.
Well, let me talk quickly about some of these others here. All of these societies have a silent generation. They were called the air raid generation in England. I mean, this was the kids of World War II. All of these societies had a boomer generation. This is the 68 generation in Paris, in Bonn. This is the Euro terrorism, the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Red Brigade. We had the same in China. This was the Red Guard generation that brought us the Cultural Revolution in China. And Generation X is throughout this whole area of the world. There's rap in Taiwan and Algeria and France and Germany. They hate politics. They hate ideology. They're into buying low, selling high. They're very market oriented, and we do have certain signs of a new millennial generation coming along. But anyway, the short answer is we do see these generations often abroad. And in fact, you'll be interested in the first translation of The Fourth Turning into another language was into Chinese. The Chinese are fascinated by generations, and they are strongly attracted to cyclical images and theories of history.
I could see that. I would imagine if it isn't yet, it should be in Farsi for this generation coming up in Iran.
good point, yes.
First-time caller line, Dan, thanks for hanging on.
Sure, no problem. I'm actually calling as a listener that's a member of the millennial generation. I'm 22 years old. Born in 1987, logged on to the internet the first time probably when I was 10 years old, was in eighth grade for 9/11. So from my point of view, I don't really have a question, but just an observation that I've had about my parents' generation and the people that have raised our generation. I think a lot of us really look up to our parents' generation just because kind of the 1960s and all that is a big, at least for me, I view it as a crucial point in history. And I admire my parents for being a part of that and their whole generation. But I think there are definitely a lot of shortcomings with how they've raised us. And I think we have very different outlooks. Like I would say the baby boomers are a lot more stubborn and a lot more kind of set in their ways, and I wouldn't say selfish, but I think people from our age take a little bit more responsibility and are a lot more open-minded to changing their outlook on things, just because
More willing to compromise.
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, well, let's Neil, talk to Dan.
Those are stinging words to boomers when you say that they're getting old and set in their ways. But I see the same things you do. I mean, the selfish, the boomers invented the me generation terminology. They thought that was good for America.
I mean, from my point of view, there are so many parents that get divorced. And from my point of view, I'm not married yet, but I would be willing to compromise for the sake of my children to stay in a steady marriage. And I feel like the boomer generation just has the attitude of, well, I can do whatever I want. I'm an individual. What I think is right is right.
Well, I know that there's truth to that. Let me just throw a thought in and see if Neil Howe will agree on this. Is that part of this is that then generations like Dan's are going to be slower to marry. They're going to take a lot longer. They're going to, by the time they actually get married, if they get married, it will be as a result of a different process than baby boomers. Yes? No?
I don't think so. No. You know, Gen Xers, I think, have pushed the marriage age out as far as they can push it. We see new evidence. In fact, it's already being confirmed by census data that that kids are pairing up a little bit earlier because they don't want to wait until... Look, if someone is alone until age 35, is that going to make it easier for them to get married and become responsible, you know, for each other? I mean, think about it.
Well, I'm contrasting this with the research that's being done on men. So I offer that to you not as just sort of a purely observational sense, but there's a lot of research that says that men are unprepared to get married. They're growing up in a much more sheltered environment than they ever have before. Women may be inclined to get married at a lower age, but that they are finding fewer marryable partners of their in their age group who are interested in going out and getting a job and being self-sufficient. And well, that's the research that's being done on this next generation of boys turning into men, which I thought was very interesting.
Like, Ian, you may be right. The oldest millennials are now just now reaching the median marriage age right now. And so we really have to wait a few years to see what the millennial effect will be. But I will say this, and in defense of our caller here, I have a lot of millennials tell me that the reason they do speed dating and they go online, you know, to, you know, for these marriage dating service, you know, these kind of dating services,
right,
and all that, is because they're often just amazed at the way their own parents met, right? They were drunk at a bar together or something. I mean, what kind of way to meet is that? I mean, they sometimes think boomers did everything in a very risky, completely haphazard fashion than when they were young. Never gave a thought about tomorrow. And then suddenly they woke up, right? And there they were in midlife wondering, gosh, yeah, I wonder if I'm, you know, really being true to me or not. I think I sense in millennials a real sense of, wait a second, this is important. Let's plan ahead. Let's think about this for a while. Let's try to analyze it a bit and maybe plan it a bit better.
Carrie is in Brighton, Colorado for Neil Howe on Coast to Coast. Carrie, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is a real thrill. I have been really giving this book away to all my friends. My question is, in the Civil War saeculum, you mentioned that sometimes the generation's kind of shortened, and there may have been like a real short generation so that it didn't go the full 80 years or whatever, and that contributed to the violence of the Civil War. Do you see this happening in this saeculum? I'm kind of scared because what I see is the crushing debt shortening the crisis period.
Really good question, Carrie, and I just want to say that here's someone who comes at this conversation with the full terminology of the saeculum and everything
else. Indeed. Well-informed.
Exactly. This is a well-informed reader. It is true that the length of generations, and by the way, not only in America but throughout the world, shortened sometime in the late 18th and early 19th century. And so that was an observation we made in generations, and that was certainly true for the generations involved in the Civil War, shortened slightly. We think that was a one-time shift, and we've sort of had debates about what was happening sort of in society that did that. I don't see that the more time goes by, the more I do not see this as being a shortened saeculum. You're right. We did ascribe the extreme destructiveness of the Civil War. I mean, that's the one crisis America has had, which is easy to imagine that could have turned out a lot better than it did. I mean, that was a devastating crisis that resulted in the deaths of one quarter of all combat-age males in the South, something like a tenth of all males in the North. I mean, it was enormously destructive, and it put practically every progressive purpose or crusade on hold for the next four decades. It was related to the fact that this crisis came a little bit early for all of the generations involved. As I look today at these generations and as I look at millennials maturing, I don't see a premature crisis. I see that things are maturing pretty much on schedule. So I'm hopeful that this is not an early fourth turning, and I think that we need not worry about a premature fourth turning. Thank you for your question.
Arthur in North Carolina on Coast to Coast for Neil Howe. Arthur?
Yeah, I'm a long fan of your book, and I've used it, and actually with your permission, in a couple of continuing education programs. Quick observation, just to get your view on this. I'd like to look at the catalyst of the fourth turning being 9/11. It meets all of the characteristics that you described in the book, and that we were basically over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years since then, coalescing into the left and right, which you describe in your book will happen in the first half of the fourth turning. It looks like we've done that, and that basically everyone is expecting, or you can kind of see the events as they happened in the 30s leading up to what was Pearl Harbor, and that a lot of people are looking at events of history and then expecting the climax to be coming up. Could we, in fact, look at the war in terror as the war in Europe was to the last crisis before it became World War II?
Neil?
That's what I'd like to get a view on. And then I have a second follow-up question to the generations after that.
That probably will take us to the bottom of the hour, but go ahead, Neil. You have a response for that?
That's a great question. After 9/11, obviously everyone asked us that. It was 9/11, the beginning of the fourth turning, and, you know, our book, you know, surged in sales. We said at the time that no, that was not. We said the generations were too young. Millennials were not yet entering adulthood. Boomers weren't yet retiring. And I stick by that judgment today. The parallel to the 9/11 would be a precursor event to the fourth turning, which foreshadows the mood but is not part of the era. A good example would be the Stamp Act crisis in 1765, which was nearly 10 years before the actual, you know, Boston Tea Party and the outbreak of the American Revolution. Another one would be the Red Scare and the Wall Street bombing of 1920 and 21 that was a mini crisis, but was, you know, roughly almost 10 years before the great crash of 29. We do have events which occasionally galvanize the country, lead us into a sense of urgency. Certainly World War I did that to some extent, foreshadowed the mood of the Great Depression and World War II, but we're not of it. And I would say that my judgment would be 9/11 would be one of those kinds of events, a precursor event, but not part of the fourth turning. A better date for us would be 2008, which is a broader scale event.
Okay. Now, Arthur, if you can keep a second question short, that's fine, but we really are pretty pressed here. Go ahead, Arthur.
Yeah, I just follow up. I was looking at the first World Trade Center bombing as one of those precursors, but I wanted to make an observation on the generations, is that when we see the banter over the health care debate by the baby boomers, and you describe what would happen if the baby boomers do not provide leadership into the next crisis era, I can tell you I'm a Generation Xer myself, and I have quite a bit of black and white thinking, and it's kind of scary to think that we might be left to lead us through this crisis, because I could definitely see it bringing us to a dark place.
All right.
Of my contemporaries.
Okay, that's got to be it for time. Arthur, like I said, we have a pretty pressed for time. Quick follow-up, Neil Howe?
I'm worried, too. I think I've already talked about this health care reform bill. It is not addressing the ostensible purpose of the reform bill, which is to rein in galloping and unsustainable cost growth in health care. And I think that's a huge bait and switch by Congress. And I wait in vain for someone to raise this issue. This bill is not doing what it was intended to do.
We'll let that wrap that up there, and then we'll come back for more questions and comments for Neil Howe, The Fourth Turning, and many other books, all speaking to generational understandings and how we're going to be affected by them and these changes that are coming in the years ahead. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All I can promise is that everybody that's on hold right now will get on the air this half hour with their questions for Neil Howe. And if If you have more questions for Neil Howe, I can promise you we'll get him back on the air again coming up, I'm sure, in the beginning part of 2010. That's just how it works. We have come to trust Neil Howe's understanding of the world and this research as both a demographer and a historian and an economist, and in the way in which it's predicting our future based on how it has worked in the past. And we'll get to your question specifically, perhaps even back to the question about what business would one go into right now if one wanted to appeal most in this fourth turning? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Bunnett. Well, where do we pick it up? Let's start with who's been on the longest, and I think that brings us up to Michael in Eugene, Oregon, on Coast to Coast for Neil Howe. Michael? Michael?
Vivian, are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah, I feel so honored. You know, it's like I live right here in a college town, and it's like I still go out and interact with the college students in town, and you know, I love them. You know, it's like I feel like they're open-minded. It's just what we've taught them. I'm 57 years old, so I fall right into the end of the baby boomer generation. I still go out and I dance and I interact and I'm very active. And
how old did you say? You said you were 57?
I'm 57, yeah.
And that doesn't put you in the end of the baby boomers, though, does it?
Oh, I don't know. I guess what's the middle of the baby boomers? About 60 or so?
I think the 1960, Neil, isn't that the last year that you considered?
Yeah, if he is age 57, he's probably right around in the middle of it all.
Okay,
yeah.
Right around in the middle of it all. The one thing that's always, and then I have a good question. The one thing that has always bothered me here, I'm right in the middle of Hippieville, you know, to where we've raised these children to be open-minded, and, you know, they're not racist anymore. They're not, you know, they're not judgmental and everything. But I feel like a lot of my generation is like closed-minded in a way, to where it's like they feel like it's okay to be whoever you want, and we believe everyone should be and have the right to be who they want as long as they think like we do, you know. And it's like it's kind of hypocritical, our generation, or sometimes the people in our age group is. But my question was what's going to happen like in 20, 25 years when I'm 80, you know? And it's like, that's one thing that concerns me sometimes.
All right.
You know?
Neil?
Well, I boomers have always been a values-driven generation. And far from being value-free, they've always wanted to commit themselves to something, you know. They even to religion. They're sort of, you know, sort of. They believe in serial orthodoxy. You know, you go to one orthodoxy and then you go to another orthodoxy. They may espouse several positions, but each time they're totally into it. And I think that this values orientation of boomers drove them when they were young to be very judgmental of older generations. And now that they're old, they're very judgmental of younger generations. They're always judging other people. People recognize that about boomers. I'll tell you something interesting. Back in the late 60s, almost everything written about values in America was about college kids. It was greening of America, the counterculture, all of that stuff. And today, almost everything about values is written about people in their 50s. It's red zone and blue zone, and it's culture wars, and it's all these boomers going at each other. We will carry that debate with us to our grave. And other generations will sometimes honor us and respect us for that and sometimes hate us for it.
Well, let me ask you that. I think that brings me back to the question about how would talk radio change then? How will it change if that's an anachronism, if this idea of, you know, my values or your values, and
I think one thing is clear, that the whole point counterpoint crossfire mode will go out of fashion for millennials. They really don't like that. I mean, they don't mind seeing it when older people do it, but they themselves will not do it. They want something that's consensualist, where a team of people to come on the air and actually educate people about what's going on and suggest ways in which we can all be happy and all agree with each other, rather than having two people rip each other to pieces, which is mainly what a lot of talk radio is about. I mean, it's very it's kind of predicated on adversarial combat.
Yeah, I would say perhaps then more about process oriented talk radio as opposed to conclusion based talk radio.
That may be one way to put it. But I think that this is going to lead to huge changes, for instance, in the practice of law, in medicine, and a lot of professions. You're going to see a more expert-based, consensualist approach, and you're going to see the phasing out of, you know, the opinionated titans that go at each other with hammer and tongs.
East of the Rockies, Mike is in Winchester, Virginia, on Coast to Coast. Mike?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
I was wondering, when, if ever, do you think the next turning will bring about a renewed effort in space activity?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's going to happen in the fourth turning only if it's somehow related to, you know, getting out of the problems we're in. I mean, it's going to have to be, has to have to be a very practical, pragmatic, nationalist bottom line for us to spend resources on it. I don't know if you noticed, but we're running a deficit of over 10% of GDP. I don't know if there's much left for a Mars trip. But come the first turning, maybe beginning in the 2020s, then once this is all settled, once we're saving again, hopefully, once we're running surpluses, once our entire economy is tilted back toward investment in infrastructure, and once we kind of agree on who we are as a nation again, I'm speaking here because I'm an optimist, so I'm going to speak that way, then we're going to start thinking, okay, where's the new frontier? And, you know, hopefully we can be in America like we were in the 50s and be planning on, you know, planning on great new frontiers to conquer. I would love to see it again personally.
Well, maybe a good time then to throw in this question again. What would be the businesses of the future if one were to be imagining the perfect market position to be in for this next turning? What would one be doing?
Me? If I were setting out today as an entrepreneur? I think the one I hate to say this. I mean, I'm going to probably, people will think ill of me for saying this, but it seems obvious to me that the great growth industry early in a fourth turning is being a lobbyist.
Hmm.
Practically all the money now is coming out of D.C. I mean, you want to get, don't go to New York. That's not where the money is. Wall Street doesn't have the money. We have the money here in D.C. And have you seen the size of these stimulus packages coming out of D.C.? If you can get a voice in how just even a tiny percentage of that money is allocated, you are a rich man forever. And I'll tell you, I live in the D.C. area, and the housing prices around here and the economy around here has been hardly affected. I say that with a little bit of shame because I think it's unfair.
Let's get to Marcia in California on Coast to Coast for Neil Howe. Marcia?
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for this lovely conversation tonight. I'm wondering, after listening to all the turnings, just how the past may repeat itself or not. I'm looking at the way the generations treat their elderly. And now that the baby boomers in mass are turning into the autumn and to the end of their years, are we looking at Soylent Green? Or are we looking at the possibility that maybe baby boomers are going to be living in the homes of their children and their children are going to be paid to care for them?
Well, that's a great question. I'll tell you one interesting thing that's happened. Attitudes toward multi-generational living, which reached an all-time low in the 1970s. In the 70s, no one wanted to live together. The decade of the 70s experienced the fastest decline in the average size of a household of any decade in American history. No one wanted to live together. Seniors are going to Sun City. Boomers are going to Wheeler Ranch Commune. parents were getting divorced. I mean, you know, we all broke up. But in the 80s, increasingly in the 90s, and especially in this decade, people are living together more. Grown kids are now living with their boomer parents. And I get, look, a lot of employers are contemptuous of that. They look at these kids and they say, you're still living with your mom and dad. You know, that's just, that's unbelievable. How can you live with yourself? Well, there is a good side to this. Think about Social Security and Medicare. Think of some of the enormous fiscal overhang. And these are resource costs that, frankly, we don't know now how we're going to face as a society. If we see a huge return of multi-generational living, and if those McMansions that boomers have built for themselves all across America suddenly at last finally serve a purpose because their millennial kids live there, and, you know, in time, there's going to be the master bedroom coup d'etat, right? The millennial couple will move into the master bedroom and the boomers will, I don't know, go down to the basement or something, right? I mean, that's going to happen.
The guest suite. Right.
Well, that would be a solution to this thing, right? I mean, I think that would be highly positive. Generations that actually get along, millennials already get along very well with their parents. We know from surveys that increasingly teenagers are saying that they want to live near their parents when they get older. I think this is a positive trend. I think it could have enormous positive implications fiscally, socially, economically. I think it could bring a return to the Frank Capra America. I don't know if you remember, you know, those movies like You Can't Take It With You and It's a Wonderful Life and all those generations living together in the same house. I don't know what's bad with that. I think it'd be a nice place to a nice thing to experience.
Don't forget the Andy Hardy movies.
exactly.
Right?
Because
the grandparents lived in the same house with the Judge and Hardy family and the whole bit. You know, interesting, though, too, I think that speaks to the comfort, though, that the millennials would have with the values of the baby boomers or the Gen Xers that taught them that if they're not disagreeing so much with their parents, it would be easy to have the parents be there to have an influence over their own kids.
This is true. Look, there's only one thing that boomers want as they get older. Look, they know no one's going to be calling them senior citizens, and they probably won't have much political clout as they get older. It's already beginning to fade. But they always want to be culturally powerful, and they always want younger people to listen to them and listen to their values messages. And how could they do that any better than by living in the same household and being able to be that, you know, great repository of wisdom? And they're going to love that. I mean, they're going to
totally
love passing on this wisdom.
And I just, in the previous generation constellation, that actually would have been very hard to have. And a lot of people balked at that in the way that we saw, like, in All of the Family, right?
With the GIs. With the GIs, it didn't happen at all. Boomers had all the wisdom, and we hated our GI parents. You know, we didn't want to listen to their wisdom at all, and we didn't even think they had any.
Right.
But the last time we had a boomer-like generation, a generation born after a great crisis, was the missionary generation, born in the 1860s and 70s. And they were the old people who showed up in those Frank Capra movies. I don't know if you remember those characters, but they were wise. They were the wise old men and women. They were the grandmother willows and these, you know, wise old titans. And they always had extremely introspective and philosophical things to say about the world. They were the visionaries. They were the generation of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Henry Stimson and Einstein and Douglas MacArthur. And, you know, I mean, they were titans, and younger people look up to them.
Let's get Carl in Denver, first time caller line for Neil Howe. And then we have to leave some time for Joe, and then that may be it. So we'll just have to keep your question short if we can. Carl.
Great show, Ian.
Thank you.
Mr. Howe, I've been a fan of yours since the article you wrote in The Atlantic in around 1992.
Oh, wow. Long time.
It was the first thing I ever read that made sense to me about my generation. I was wondering, I'm Generation X, the very beginning of it, and I was wondering if you see the same parallels between my generation and the lost generation in terms of how they became more conservative as they got older, and especially, I guess, after the Depression hit. Do you see that happening now with people who were born in the 60s and 70s?
It's not something that's happening. It already happened. Very late wave boomers born in the late 50s and early wave Xers born in the early 60s are a conservative cohort. They lean 60-40 Republican. The early wave boomers lean 60-40 Democrat. And I'm telling you, you can see that in members of Congress. I mean, it's exactly those percentages. Those early wave Xers, they grew up in the 60s. They saw those Child as Devil horror movies when they were little. They came of age during the Iran hostage crisis in the early Reagan years. And I'll tell you one interesting thing. When Reagan died and they had his body in the rotunda in the Capitol, of all the lines that showed up to see Reagan lying in state, there were so many people in their late 30s. I mean, exactly that cohort showed up en masse. The tremendous resonance with the first wave of Generation X going into, they were becoming, I don't know, learning to be power tools in business schools. They were signing up for the all-volunteer army. This was the, you remember the MTV and the beginning of rap at that time, so a whole hip-hop scene. Very interesting time. And that early wave of X, they didn't trust the system. They wanted another way. They believed in themselves, and they took a different path. And I think a lot of them are feeling politically a little bit not welcome at the moment. But you know, who knows? Their moment may come back.
Joe in Daytona Beach, just to live up to my promise. So I got everybody that was up when we first started this segment. I don't know how many more we'll get to, but Joe, you have your chance with Neil Howe.
Yes, Mr. Howe. Nice to talk to you. I've kept up with you for many years.
Great.
And you've got your pulse on a lot of things. And I'm 67, born in 42, Vietnam veteran, 38 years in law enforcement. And I study people, and I travel a lot. And there's one thing I've noticed lately that I would like to touch base on the China.
Got to be really quick here, Joe. You got to get to the question, so go ahead.
This is it right now. What I want to know is, why haven't we been discussing the more than 10% of people in the mid portion of China to the east that are getting ready to follow Mao Zedong?
Okay. Neil, thought on that?
10%, we're getting ready to follow what?
I believe he was talking about following Mao, right?
Mao.
Did he say Mao Zedong?
Look, the only thing I know about China, if you're talking about west to east, is the enormous migration of young adults from west to east into those eastern cities, like Shanghai, and that's Generation X today. They have no safety nets, they have no health care, they have no public education, they're all on their own. A hundred million Chinese, the shadow army, the unemployed, they're building China. They're working on these skyscrapers and highways, and
that's going to have to do.
They're
it.
On their own. That's a market economy for them. And
all right, that's going to have to do it. We're running out of time. So thank you so much, Neil Howe. Joe, I hope you can find your answers in any of his books. You can link up to Neil there at our website at coasttocoastam.com. The Department of Mad Scientists tomorrow night. Deus Tamat, and I do too. Thanks, Neil.